And now, Chapter 20, The Super Excellent Power of Krishna. Long, long ago, there was an assembly of great sages on the bank of the river Sarasvati, who performed a great sacrifice of the name Satrayagya. In such assemblies, the great sages present usually discuss Vedic subject matters and philosophical topics. And in this particular meeting, the following question was raised. The three predominating deities of this material world, namely Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu, and Lord Shiva, are directing all the affairs of this cosmos. But who among them is the supreme? After much discussion on this question, the great sage named Bhrigu, the son of Lord Brahma, was deputed to test all three predominating deities and report to the assembly as to who is the greatest. Being thus deputed, the great sage Bhrigu Muni first of all went to his father's residence in Brahmaloka. The three deities are the controllers of the three material qualities, namely the qualities of goodness, passion, and ignorance. The plan decided upon by the sages was for Bhrigu to test which of the predominating deities possesses the quality of goodness in full. Therefore, when Bhrigu Muni reached his father, Lord Brahma, because he wanted to test whether he had the quality of goodness, he purposely did not offer his respects to his father, either by offering obeisances or by offering prayers. It is the duty of a son or a disciple to offer respects and recite suitable prayers when he approaches his father or spiritual master. But Bhrigu Muni purposely failed to offer respects just to see Lord Brahma's reaction to this negligence. Lord Brahma was very angry at his son's impudence, and he showed signs which definitely proved this to be so. He was even prepared to condemn Bhrigu by cursing him, but because Bhrigu was his son, Lord Brahma controlled his anger with his great intelligence. This means that although the quality of passion was prominent in Lord Brahma, he had the power to control it. Lord Brahma's anger and his controlling his anger are likened to fire and water. Water is produced from fire, but fire can be extinguished with water. Similarly, although Lord Brahma was very angry due to his quality of passion, he could still control his passion because Bhrigu Muni was his son. After testing Lord Brahma, Bhrigu Muni went directly to the planet Kailas, where Lord Shiva resides. Bhrigu Muni happened to be Lord Shiva's brother. Therefore, as soon as Bhrigu Muni approached, Lord Shiva was very glad and personally rose to embrace him. But when Lord Shiva approached, Bhrigu Muni refused to embrace him. "My dear brother," he said, "you are always very impure. Because you smear your body with ashes, you are not very clean. So please do not touch me." When Bhrigu Muni refused to embrace his brother, saying that Lord Shiva was impure, the latter became very angry with him. It is said that an offense can be committed either with the body, with the mind, or by speech. Bhrigu Muni's first offense, committed towards Lord Brahma, was an offense with the mind. His second offense, committed towards Lord Shiva by insulting him, criticizing him for unclean habits, was an offense by speech. Because the quality of ignorance is prominent in Lord Shiva, when he heard Bhrigu's insult, his eyes immediately became red with anger. With uncontrollable rage, he took up his trident and prepared to kill Bhrigu Muni. At that time, Lord Shiva's wife, Parvati, was present. Her personality is a mixture of the three qualities, and therefore she is called Trigunamayi. In this case, she saved the situation by evoking Lord Shiva's quality of goodness. She fell down at the feet of her husband, and with her sweet words, she talked him out of killing Bhrigu Muni. After being saved from the anger of Lord Shiva, Bhrigu Muni went directly to the planet Shvetadvip, where Lord Vishnu was lying on a bed of flowers, accompanied by his wife, the goddess of fortune, who was engaged in massaging his lotus feet. There, Bhrigu Muni purposely committed the greatest sin by offending Lord Vishnu by his bodily activities. The first offense committed by Bhrigu Muni was mental. The second offense was vocal. And the third offense, corporal. These different offenses are progressively greater in degree. An offense committed within the mind is a positive offense. The same offense committed verbally is comparatively more grave. And when committed by bodily action, it is superlative in offensiveness. So Bhrigu Muni committed the greatest offense by touching the chest of the Lord with his foot in the presence of the goddess of fortune. Of course, Lord Vishnu is all merciful. He did not become angry at the activities of Bhrigu Muni, for Bhrigu Muni was a great Brahman. A Brahman is to be excused even if he sometimes commits an offense, and Lord Vishnu set the example. Yet it is said that from the time of this incident, the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, has not been very favorably disposed towards the Brahmins, and therefore, because the goddess of fortune withholds her benedictions from them, the Brahmins are generally very poor. Bhrigu Muni's touching the chest of Lord Vishnu with his foot was certainly a great offense, but Lord Vishnu is so great that he did not care. The so-called Brahmins of the Kali Yuga are sometimes very proud that they can touch the chest of Lord Vishnu with their feet. But when Bhrigu Muni touched the chest of Lord Vishnu with his feet, it was different, because although it was the greatest offense, Lord Vishnu, being greatly magnanimous, did not take it very seriously. Instead of being angry or cursing Bhrigu Muni, Lord Vishnu immediately got up from his bed along with his wife, the goddess of fortune, and offered respectful obeisances to the Brahmin. He addressed Bhrigu Muni as follows. My dear Brahmin, it is a great blessing for me that you have come here. Please, therefore, sit down on this cushion for a few minutes. My dear Brahmin, I am very sorry that when you first entered, I could not receive you properly. It was a great offense on my part. I beg you to pardon me. You are so pure and great that the water which washes your feet can purify even the places of pilgrimage. Therefore, I request you to purify the Vaikuntha planet where I live with my associates. My dear father, O great sage, I know that your feet are very soft, like a lotus flower, and that my chest is as hard as a thunderbolt. I am therefore afraid that you may have felt some pain by touching my chest with your feet. Let me touch your feet to relieve the pain you have suffered. Lord Vishnu then began to massage the feet of Bhrigu Muni. The Lord continued to address Bhrigu Muni. My dear Lord, he said, my chest has now become sanctified because of the touch of your feet, and I am now assured that the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, will be very glad to live there perpetually. Another name for Lakshmi is Chanchala, indicating that she does not stay in one place for a long time. Therefore, we see that a rich man's family sometimes becomes poor after a few generations, and sometimes we see that a poor man's family becomes very rich. Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, is Chanchala in this material world, whereas in the Vaikuntha planets, she eternally lives at the lotus feet of the Lord. Because Lakshmi is famous as Chanchala, Lord Narayan indicated that she might not have been living perpetually by his chest. But because his chest had been touched by the feet of Bhrigu Muni, it was now sanctified, and there was no chance that the goddess of fortune would leave. Bhrigu Muni, however, could understand his position and that of the Lord, and he was struck with wonder at the behavior of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because of his gratitude, his voice choked up, and he was unable to reply to the words of the Lord. Tears glided from his eyes, and he could not say anything. He simply stood silently before the Lord. After testing Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Lord Vishnu, Bhrigu Muni returned to the assembly of great sages on the bank of the river Sarasvati and described his experience. After hearing him with great attention, the sages concluded that of all the predominating deities, certainly Vishnu is situated in the mode of goodness in the highest degree. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, these great sages are described as Brahma Vadanam. Brahma Vadanam means those who talk about the absolute truth, but have not yet come to a conclusion. Generally, Brahma Vadi refers to the impersonalists, or to those who are students of the Vedas. It is to be understood, therefore, that all the gathered sages were serious students of Vedic literature, but had not come to definite conclusions as to who is the Supreme Absolute Personality of Godhead. After hearing of Bhrigu Muni's experience in meeting all three predominating deities, Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, and Lord Vishnu, the sages concluded that Lord Vishnu is the Supreme Truth, the Personality of Godhead. It is said in the Srimad Bhagavatam that after hearing the details from Bhrigu Muni, the sages were astonished because, although Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva were immediately agitated, Lord Vishnu, in spite of being kicked by Bhrigu Muni, was not agitated in the least. The example is given that small lamps may be agitated by a slight breeze, but the greatest lamp or the greatest illuminating source, the sun, is never moved even by the greatest hurricane. One's greatness has to be estimated by one's ability to tolerate provoking situations. the sages gathered on the bank of the river Sarasvati concluded that if one wants actual peace and freedom from all fear, he should take shelter of the lotus feet of Vishnu. If Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva lost their peaceful attitude upon a slight provocation, how could they maintain the peace and tranquility of their devotees? As for Lord Vishnu, however, it is stated in the Bhagavad Gita that anyone who accepts Lord Vishnu or Krishna as the supreme friend attains the highest perfection of peaceful life. The sages thus concluded that by following the principles of Vaishnava Dharma, one becomes actually perfect. But if one follows all the religious principles of a particular sect and does not become advanced in understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, all such labor of love is fruitless. To execute religious principles means to come to the platform of perfect knowledge. If one comes to the platform of perfect knowledge, then he will be uninterested in material affairs. Perfect knowledge means knowledge of one's own self and the Supreme Self. The Supreme Self and the individual self, although one in quality, are different in quantity. This analytical understanding of knowledge is perfect. Simply to understand, I am not matter, I am spirit, is not perfect knowledge. The real religious principle is devotional service or bhakti. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Lord Krishna says, "Give up all other religious principles and simply surrender unto me." Therefore, the term dharma applies only to the Vaishnava dharma or Bhagavad dharma, following which all other good qualities and advancements in life are automatically achieved. The highest perfectional knowledge is knowledge of the Supreme Lord. He cannot be understood by any process of religion other than devotional service. Therefore, the immediate result of perfect knowledge is achieved by executing devotional service. After attainment of knowledge, one becomes uninterested in the material world. This is not because of dry philosophical speculation. The devotees become uninterested in the material world not simply because of theoretical understanding, but because of practical experience. When a devotee realizes the effect of association with the Supreme Lord, he naturally hates the association of so-called society, friendship, and love. This detachment is not dry, but is due to achieving a higher status of life by relishing transcendental mellows. It is further stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam that after attainment of such knowledge and detachment from material sense gratification, one's advancement in the eight opulences attained by mystic yoga practice, such as the anima, lagima, and prapti siddhis, is also achieved without separate effort. The perfect example is Maharaj Ambarish. He was not a mystic yogi, but a great devotee. Yet in a disagreement with Maharaj Ambarish, the great mystic Durvasa was defeated in the presence of his devotional attitude. In other words, a devotee does not need to practice the mystic yoga system to achieve power. The power is behind him by the grace of the Lord, just as when a small child is surrendered to a powerful father, all the powers of the father are behind him. When a person becomes famous as a devotee of the Lord, his reputation is never to be extinguished. Lord Chaitanya, when discoursing with Ramananda Rai, questioned, "What is the greatest fame?" Ramananda Rai replied, "That to be known as a pure devotee of Lord Krishna is the perfect fame." The conclusion, therefore, is that Vishnu Dharma, or the religion of devotional service unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is meant for persons who are thoughtful. By proper utilization of thoughtfulness, one comes to the stage of thinking of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By thinking of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one becomes free from the contamination of the faulty association of the material world, and thus one becomes peaceful. The world is in a disturbed condition because of a scarcity of such peaceful devotees in human society. Unless one is a devotee, one cannot be equal to all living entities. A devotee is equally disposed towards the animals, the human beings, and all living entities, because he sees every living entity as a part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. In the Ishopanishad, it is clearly stated that one who has come to the stage of seeing all living beings equally does not hate anyone or favor anyone. The devotee does not hanker to possess more than he requires. Devotees are therefore akinchana. In any condition of life, a devotee is satisfied. It is said that a devotee is even-minded, whether he is in hell or in heaven. A devotee is callous to all subjects other than his engagement in devotional service. This mode of life is the highest perfectional stage from which one can be elevated to the spiritual world, back home, back to Godhead. The devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are especially attracted by the highest material quality, goodness, and the qualified Brahman is the symbolic representation of this goodness. Therefore, a devotee is attached to the brahminical stage of life. He is not very much interested in passion or ignorance, although these qualities also emanate from the Supreme Lord Vishnu. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, the devotees are described as Nipuna Buddhi, which means that they are the most intelligent class of men. Uninfluenced by attachment or hatred, the devotee lives very peacefully and is not agitated by the influence of passion and ignorance. It may be questioned here why a devotee should be attached to the quality of goodness in the material world if he is transcendental to all material qualities. The answer is that there are different kinds of people existing in the modes of material nature. Those in the mode of ignorance are called rakshasas. Those in the mode of passion are called asuras. And those in the mode of goodness are called suras, or demigods. Under the direction of the Supreme Lord, these three classes of men are created by material nature, but those in the mode of goodness have a greater chance to be elevated to the spiritual world, back home, back to Godhead. Thus all the sages who assembled on the bank of the river Sarasvati to try to determine who is the supreme predominating deity became freed from all doubts about Vishnu worship. All of them, thereafter, engaged in devotional service, and thus they achieved the desired result and went back to Godhead. those who are actually anxious to be liberated from material entanglement would do better to accept at once the conclusion given by Sri Shukdev Goswami in the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam. It is said there that hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam is extremely conducive to liberation because it is spoken by Shukdev Goswami. The same fact is again confirmed by Suta Goswami. If anyone who is traveling aimlessly within this material world cares to hear the nectarian words spoken by Shukdev Goswami, certainly he will come to the right conclusion. Simply by discharging devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he will be able to stop the fatigue of perpetually migrating from one material body to another. In other words, by proper hearing, one will become fixed in loving devotional service to Vishnu. He will certainly be able to get relief from this material journey of life. And the process is very simple. One has to give oral reception to the sweet words spoken by Shukdev Goswami in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam. Another conclusion is that we should never consider the demigods, even Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, to be on an equal level with Lord Vishnu. If we do this, then according to Padma Purana, we immediately become atheists. In the Vedic literature, known as Hari Vamsa, it is also stated that only the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, is to be worshipped. The Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, or any such Vishnu mantra, is always to be chanted. In the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Brahma says, "Both Lord Shiva and I are engaged by the Supreme Personality of Godhead to act in different capacities under His direction." In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is also stated that the only master is Krishna, and all others in all categories of life are servants of Krishna. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is confirmed by the Lord that there is no truth superior to Krishna. Shukdev Goswami also, in order to draw attention to the fact that among all Vishnu Tattva forms, Lord Krishna is 100% the Supreme Personality of Godhead, narrated the story of an incident which took place when Lord Krishna was present. Once upon a time, a Brahmin's wife gave birth to a child. Unfortunately, however, just after being born and touching the ground, the child immediately died. The Brahmin father took the child and went directly to Dwarka, to the palace of the king. The Brahmin was very upset because of the untimely death of the child in the presence of his young father and mother. Thus his mind became very disturbed. Formerly, when there were responsible kings, up to the time of Dwapara Yuga, when Lord Krishna was present, the king was liable to be blamed for the untimely death of a child in the presence of his parents. Similarly, such responsibility was there during the time of Lord Ramachandra. As we have explained in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the king was so responsible for the comforts of the citizens that he was to see that there was not even excessive heat or cold. Now, although there was no fault on the part of the king, the Brahmin whose child had died immediately went to the palace door and accused the king as follows. "The present king, Ugrasen, is envious of the Brahmins. The exact word used in this connection is Brahma Dvisha. One who is envious of the Vedas, of a qualified Brahmin, or of the Brahmin caste, is called Brahma Dvit. So the king was accused of being Brahma Dvit. He was also accused of being Shatadhi, falsely intelligent. The executive head of a state must be very intelligent to see to the comforts of the citizens. But according to the Brahmin, the king was not at all intelligent, although he was occupying the royal throne. Therefore, the Brahmin also called him Lubdha, which means greedy. In other words, a king or an executive head of state should not occupy the exalted post of president or king if he is greedy and self-interested. But it is natural that an executive head becomes self-interested when he is attached to material enjoyment. Therefore, another word used here is Vishayatmana. The Brahmin also accused the king of being Kshatrabandhu, which refers to a person born in the family of Kshatriyas or the royal order, but lacking the qualifications of a royal personality. A king should protect Brahminical culture and should be very alert to the welfare of his citizens. He should not be greedy due to attachment to material enjoyment. If a person with no qualifications represents himself as a Kshatriya of the royal order, he is not called a Kshatriya, but a Kshatrabandhu. Similarly, if a person is born of a Brahmin father but has no Brahminical qualification, he is called Brahmabandhu or Dvijabandhu. This means that a Brahmin or Kshatriya is not accepted simply by birth. One has to qualify himself for the particular position. Only then is he accepted as a Brahmin or a Kshatriya. Thus, the Brahmin charged that his newly born baby was dead due to the disqualifications of the king. The Brahmin took it to be most unnatural, and therefore he held the king responsible. We also find in Vedic history that if a Kshatriya king were irresponsible, sometimes a consulting board of Brahmins maintained by the monarchy would dethrone him. Considering all these points, it appears that the post of monarch in the Vedic civilization is a very responsible one. The Brahmin therefore said, "No one should offer respects or worship to a king whose only business is envy. Such a king spends his time either hunting and killing animals in the forest or killing citizens for criminal acts. He has no self-control and possesses bad character. If such a king is worshipped or honored by the citizens will never be happy. They will always remain poor, full of anxieties and aggrievement, and always unhappy." Although in modern politics, the post of monarch is abolished, the president is not held responsible for the comforts of the citizens. In this age of Kali, the executive head of a state somehow or other gets votes and is elected to an exalted post, but the condition of the citizens continues to be full of anxiety, distress, unhappiness, and dissatisfaction. The Brahmin's second child was also born dead, and the third also. He had 9 children, each born dead, and each time he came to the gate of the palace to accuse the king. When the Brahmin came to accuse the king of Dvarka for the 9th time, Arjun happened to be present with Krishna. On hearing that a Brahmin was accusing the king of not properly protecting him, Arjun became inquisitive and approached the Brahmin. He said, "My dear Brahmin, why do you say that there are no proper Kshatriyas to protect the citizens of your country? Is there not even someone who can pretend to be a Kshatriya, who can carry a bow and arrow at least to make a show of protection? Do you think that all the royal personalities in this country simply engage in performing sacrifices with the Brahmins, but have no chivalrous power?" Thus Arjun indicated that Kshatriyas should not sit back comfortably and engage only in performing Vedic rituals. Rather, they must be very chivalrous in protecting the citizens. Brahmins, being engaged in spiritual activities, are not expected to do anything which requires physical endeavor. Therefore, they need to be protected by the Kshatriyas, so that they will not be disturbed in the execution of their higher occupational duties. If the Brahmins feel unwanted separation from their wives and children, Arjun continued, and the Kshatriya kings do not take care of them, then such Kshatriyas are to be considered no more than stage players. In dramatic performances in the theater, an actor may play the part of a king, but no one expects any benefits from such a make-believe king. Similarly, if the king or the executive head of a state cannot give protection to the head of the social structure, he is considered merely a bluffer. Such executive heads simply live for their own livelihood while occupying exalted posts as chiefs of state. My lord, I promise I shall give protection to your children, and if I am unable to do so, then I shall enter into blazing fire, so that the sinful contamination which has infected me will be counteracted." Upon hearing Arjun speak in this way, the Brahmin replied, "My dear Arjun, Lord Balaram is present, but he could not give protection to my children. Lord Krishna is also present, but he also could not give them protection. There are also many other heroes, such as Pradyumna and Aniruddha, carrying bows and arrows, but they could not protect my children." The Brahmin directly hinted that Arjun could not do that which was impossible for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He felt that Arjun was promising something beyond his power. The Brahmin said, "I consider your promise to be like that of an inexperienced child. I cannot put my faith in your promise." Arjun then understood that the Brahmin had lost all faith in the Kshatriya kings. Therefore, to encourage him, Arjun spoke as if criticizing even his friend Lord Krishna. While Lord Krishna and others were listening, he specifically attacked Krishna by saying, "My dear Brahmin, I am neither Sankarshan, nor Krishna, nor one of Krishna's sons like Pradyumna or Aniruddha. My name is Arjun, and I carry the bow known as Gandiv. You cannot insult me, for I have satisfied even Lord Shiva by my prowess when we were both hunting in the forest. I had a fight with Lord Shiva, who appeared before me as a hunter, and when I satisfied him by my prowess, he gave me the weapon known as Pashupatastra. Do not doubt my chivalry. I shall bring back your sons, even if I have to fight with death personified." When the Brahmin was assured by Arjun in such exalted words, he was somehow or other convinced, and thus he returned home. When the Brahmin's wife was to give birth to another child, the Brahmin began to chant, My dear Arjun, please come now and save my child. After hearing him, Arjun immediately prepared himself by touching sanctified water and uttering holy mantras to protect his bows and arrows from danger. He specifically took the arrow presented to him by Lord Shiva, and while going out, he remembered Lord Shiva and his great favor. In this way, he appeared in front of the maternity home, equipped with his bow, known as Gandiv, and with various other weapons. Arjun, who apparently had not left Dwarka because he had to fulfill his promise to the Brahmin, was called at night when the Brahmin's wife was to give birth to the child. While going to the maternity home to attend to the delivery case of the Brahmin's wife, Arjun remembered Lord Shiva and not his friend, Krishna. He thought that since Krishna could not give protection to the Brahmin, it was better to take shelter of Lord Shiva. This is another instance of how a person takes shelter of the demigods. This is explained in the Bhagavad Gita. Kamais tais tair rita jnana. A person who loses his intelligence because of greed and lust forgets the Supreme Personality of Godhead and takes shelter of the demigods. Of course, Arjun was not an ordinary living entity, but because of his friendly dealings with Krishna, he thought that Krishna was unable to give protection to the Brahmin and that he would do better to remember Lord Shiva. Later it was proved that Arjun's taking shelter of Lord Shiva instead of Krishna was not at all successful. Arjun, however, did his best by chanting different mantras, and he took up his bow to guard the maternity home from all directions. The Brahmin's wife delivered a male child, and as usual, the child began to cry. But suddenly, within a few minutes, both the child and Arjun's arrows disappeared into the sky. It appears that the Brahmin's house was near Krishna's residence, and that Lord Krishna was enjoying everything that was taking place, apparently in defiance of his authority. It was he who played the trick of taking away the Brahmin's baby as well as the arrows, including the one given by Lord Shiva, of which Arjun was so proud. Tadbhavatyalpa medasam. Less intelligent men take shelter of the demigods due to bewilderment and are satisfied with the benefits they award. In the presence of Lord Krishna and others, the Brahmin began to accuse Arjun. Everyone see my foolishness. I put my faith in the words of Arjun, who is impotent and who is expert only in false promises. How foolish I was to believe Arjun. He promised to protect my child even when Pradyumna, Aniruddha, Lord Balaram, and Lord Krishna failed. If such great personalities could not protect my child, then who can do so? I therefore condemn Arjun for his false promise, and I also condemn his celebrated bow, Gandiv, and his impudence in declaring himself greater than Lord Balaram, Lord Krishna, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. No one can save my child, for he has already been transferred to another planet. Due to sheer foolishness only, Arjun thought he could bring back my child from another planet. Thus condemned by the Brahmin, Arjun empowered himself with a mystic yoga perfection so that he could travel to any planet to find the Brahmin's baby. It seems that Arjun had mastered the mystic yogic power by which yogis can travel to any planet they desire. He first of all went to the planet known as Yamalok, where the superintendent of death, Yamaraj, lives. There he searched for the Brahmin's baby, but was unable to find him. He then immediately went to the planet where the king of heaven, Indra, lives. When unable to find the baby there, he went to the planets of the fire demigods, then the Nairiti demigods, and then to the moon planet. Then he went to Vayu and Varuna Loka. When unable to find the baby in those planets, he went down to the Rasatala planet, the lowest of the planetary systems. After traveling to all these different planets, he finally went to Brahmalok, where even mystic yogis cannot go. By the grace of Lord Krishna, Arjuna had that power, and he went above the heavenly planets to Brahmalok. When he was unable to find the baby even after searching all possible planets, he then attempted to throw himself into a fire as he had promised the Brahmin he would, if unable to bring back his baby. Lord Krishna, however, was very kind toward Arjuna, because Arjuna was the most intimate friend of the Lord. Lord Krishna persuaded Arjuna not to enter the fire in disgrace. Krishna indicated that since Arjuna was his friend, if he were to enter the fire in hopelessness, indirectly it would be a blemish on him, Krishna. Lord Krishna therefore checked Arjuna, assuring him that he would find the baby. He told Arjuna, "Do not foolishly commit suicide." After addressing Arjuna in this way, Lord Krishna called for his transcendental chariot. He mounted it along with Arjuna and began to proceed north. Lord Krishna, the all-powerful personality of Godhead, could have brought back the child without effort. But we should always remember that he was playing the part of a human being. As a human being has to endeavor to achieve certain results, so Lord Krishna, like an ordinary human being, or like his friend Arjuna, left Dvarka to bring back the Brahmin's baby. By appearing in human society and exhibiting his pastimes as a human being, Krishna definitely showed that there was not a single personality greater than he. God is great. That is the definition of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So at least within this material world, while he was present, Krishna proved that there was no greater personality within the universe. Seated on his chariot with Arjuna, Krishna proceeded north, crossing over many planetary systems. These are described in the Srimad Bhagavatam as Saptadvip. Dvip means island. These planets are sometimes described in the Vedic literatures as Dvipas. The planet on which we are living is called Jambudvip. Outer space is taken as a great ocean of air. And within that great ocean of air, there are many islands, which are the different planets. In each and every planet, there are oceans also. In some of the planets, the oceans are of salt water, and in some of them, there are oceans of milk. In others, there are oceans of liquor, and in others, there are oceans of ghee or oil. There are different kinds of mountains also. Each and every planet has a different type of atmosphere. Krishna passed over all these planets and reached the covering of the universe. This covering is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam as great darkness. The material world as a whole is described as dark. In the open space, there is sunlight, and therefore it is illuminated. But in the covering, because of the absence of sunlight, it is naturally dark. When Krishna approached the covering layer of this universe, the four horses which were drawing his chariot, Shaibya, Sugriv, Megapushpa, and Balahak, all appeared to hesitate to enter the darkness. This hesitation is also a part of the pastimes of Lord Krishna, because the horses of Krishna are not ordinary. It is not possible for ordinary horses to go all over the universe and then enter into its outer covering layers. As Krishna is transcendental, his chariot and his horses and everything about him is also transcendental, beyond the qualities of this material world. We should always remember that Krishna was playing the part of an ordinary human being, and his horses also, by the will of Krishna, played the parts of ordinary horses in hesitating to enter the darkness. Krishna is known as Yogeshwar, as stated in the last portion of Bhagavad Gita. Yogeshwaro Hari. All mystic powers are under his control. In our experience, we can see many human beings who have yogic mystic power and who sometimes perform very wonderful acts. But Krishna is understood to be the master of all mystic power. Therefore, when he saw that his horses were hesitant to proceed into the darkness, he immediately released his disc, known as the Sudarshan Chakra, which illuminated the sky 1,000 times brighter than sunlight. The darkness of the covering of the universe is also a creation of Krishna's, and the Sudarshan Chakra is Krishna's constant companion. Thus he penetrated the darkness by keeping the Sudarshan Chakra before him. Srimad Bhagavatam states that the Sudarshan Chakra penetrated the darkness, just as an arrow released from the Shanga bow of Lord Ramachandra penetrated the army of Ravan. Su means very nice, and Darshan means observation. By the grace of Lord Krishna's disc, Sudarshan, everything can be seen very nicely, and nothing can remain in darkness. Thus Lord Krishna and Arjuna crossed over the great region of darkness covering the material universes. Arjuna then saw the effulgence of light known as the Brahma Jyoti. The Brahma Jyoti is situated outside the covering of the material universes, and because it cannot be seen with our present eyes, this Brahma Jyoti is sometimes called Avyakta. This spiritual effulgence is the ultimate destination of the impersonalists known as Vedantists. The Brahma Jyoti is also described as Ananta Param, unlimited and unfathomed. When Lord Krishna and Arjuna reached this region of the Brahma Jyoti, Arjuna could not tolerate the glaring effulgence, and he closed his eyes. Lord Krishna's and Arjuna's reaching the Brahma Jyoti region is described in the Hari Vamsha. In that portion of the Vedic literature, Krishna informs Arjuna, "My dear Arjuna, the glaring effulgence, the transcendental light you are seeing, is my bodily rays. O chief of the descendants of Bharat, this Brahma Jyoti is I myself." as the sun disk and the sunshine cannot be separated, Krishna and his bodily rays, the Brahma Jyoti, cannot be separated. Thus Krishna claims that the Brahma Jyoti is he himself. This is clearly stated in the Hari Vamsha when Krishna says, Aham Sa. The Brahma Jyoti is a combination of the minute particles known as spiritual sparks, or the living entities known as Chit Kan. The Vedic word Soham, or I am the Brahma Jyoti, can also be applied to the living entities, who can also claim to belong to the Brahma Jyoti. In the Hari Vamsha, Krishna further explains, this Brahma Jyoti is an expansion of my spiritual energy. Krishna told Arjuna, the Brahma Jyoti is beyond the region of my external energy known as Maya Shakti. When one is situated within the material world, it is not possible for him to experience this Brahman effulgence. Therefore, in the material world, this effulgence is not manifested, whereas in the spiritual world, it is manifested. That is the purport of the words vyakta avyakta. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said vyakto vyaktat sanatana. Both these energies are eternally manifested. After this, Lord Krishna and Arjuna entered a vast spiritual water. This spiritual water is called the Karananava Ocean, or Viraja, which means that this ocean is the origin of the creation of the material world. And the place is known as Viraja, because this place is free from the influence of the three qualities of the material world. In the Mrityunjaya Tantra, a Vedic literature, there is a vivid description of this Karana Ocean, or Viraja. It is stated there that the highest planetary system within the material world is Satyalok, or Brahmalok, beyond which are Rudralok and Mahavishnulok. Regarding this Mahavishnulok, it is stated in the Brahma Samhita, Ya Karana Nava Jale Bhajati Sma Yoga. Lord Mahavishnu is lying in the Karana Ocean. When he exhales, innumerable universes come into existence, and when he inhales, innumerable universes enter within him. In this way, the material creation is generated and again withdrawn. When Lord Krishna and Arjuna entered the water, it appeared that there was a strong hurricane of transcendental effulgence brewing, and the water of the Karana Ocean was greatly agitated. By the grace of Lord Krishna, Arjuna had the unique experience of being able to see the very beautiful Karana Ocean. Accompanied by Krishna, Arjuna saw a large palace within the water. There were many thousands of pillars and columns made of valuable jewels, and the glaring effulgence of those columns was so beautiful that Arjuna was charmed by it. Within that palace, Arjuna and Krishna saw the gigantic form of Ananta Dev, who is also known as Shesha. Lord Ananta Dev, or Shesha Naga, was in the form of a great serpent with thousands of hoods, each one of them decorated with valuable, effulgent jewels, beautifully dazzling. Each of Ananta Deva's hoods had two eyes, which appeared very fearful. His body was as white as the mountaintop of Kailas, which is always covered by snow. His neck was bluish, as were his tongues. Thus Arjuna saw the Shesha Naga form, and he also saw that on the very soft white body of Sheshanaga, Lord Mahavishnu was lying very comfortably. He appeared all-pervading and very powerful, and Arjuna could understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead in that form is known as Purushottam. He is known as Purushottam, the best, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because from this form emanates within the material world another form of Vishnu, known as Garbhadakshayi Vishnu. The Mahavishnu form of the Lord, Purushottam, is beyond the material world. He is also known as Uttama. Tama means darkness, and Ut means above, transcendental. Therefore, Uttama means above the darkest region of the material world. Arjuna saw that the bodily color of Purushottam, Mahavishnu, was as dark as a new cloud in the rainy season. He was dressed in very nice yellow clothing. His face was always beautifully smiling, and his eyes, which were like lotus petals, were very attractive. Lord Mahavishnu's helmet was bedecked with valuable jewels, and his beautiful earrings enhanced the beauty of the curling hair on his head. Lord Mahavishnu had 8 arms, all very long, reaching to his knees. His neck was decorated with the Kaustubha jewel, and his chest was marked with the symbol of Sri Vatsa, which means the resting place of the goddess of fortune. The Lord wore a garland of lotus flowers down to his knees. This long garland is known as a Vaijayanti garland. The Lord was surrounded by his personal associates, Nanda and Sunanda, and the personified Sudarshan disc was also standing by him. As stated in the Vedas, the Lord has innumerable energies, and they also stood there personified. The most important among them were as follows: Pushti, the energy for nourishment; Shri, the energy of beauty; Kirti, the energy of reputation; and Aja, the energy of material creation. All these energies are invested in the administrators of the material world, namely Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Lord Vishnu, and in the kings of the heavenly planets, Indra, Chandra, Varun, and the sun god. In other words, all these demigods, being empowered by the Lord with certain energies, engage in the transcendental loving service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Mahavishnu feature is an expansion of Krishna's body. The Brahma Samhita also confirms that Mahavishnu is a portion of a plenary expansion of Krishna. All such expansions are non-different from the personality of Godhead. But since Krishna appeared within this material world to manifest his pastimes as a human being, he and Arjuna immediately offered their respects to Lord Mahavishnu by bowing down before him. It is stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam that Lord Krishna offered respect to Mahavishnu. This means that he offered obeisances unto him, only because Lord Mahavishnu is non-different from he himself. This offering of obeisances by Krishna to Mahavishnu is not, however, the form of worship known as Ahangrahopasana, which is sometimes recommended for persons trying to elevate themselves to the spiritual world by performing the sacrifice of knowledge. Such persons are also mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita: Jnana Yagyena Chapyanye Yajanto Mam Upasate. although there was no necessity for Krishna to offer obeisances, because he is the master teacher, he taught Arjuna just how respect should be offered to Lord Mahavishnu. Arjuna, however, became very much afraid upon seeing the gigantic form of everything, distinct from the material experience. Seeing Krishna offering obeisances to Lord Mahavishnu, he immediately followed him and stood before the Lord with folded hands. After this, the gigantic form of Mahavishnu, greatly pleased, smiled pleasingly and spoke as follows. My dear Krishna and Arjuna, I was very anxious to see you both, and therefore I arranged to take away the babies of the Brahman and keep them here. I have been expecting to see you both at this palace. You have appeared in the material world as my incarnations in order to minimize the force of the demoniac persons who burden the world. Now, after killing all these unwanted demons, you will please come back to me. Both of you are incarnations of the great sage Naranarayan. Although you are both complete in yourselves to protect the devotees and to annihilate the demons, and especially to establish religious principles in the world so that peace and tranquility may continue, you are teaching the basic principles of factual religion so that the people of the world may follow you and thereby be peaceful and prosperous. Both Lord Krishna and Arjuna then offered their obeisances to Lord Mahavishnu. And, taking back the Brahman's children, they returned to Dvarka via the same route by which they had entered the spiritual world. All the children of the Brahman had duly grown up. After returning to Dvarka, Lord Krishna and Arjuna delivered to the Brahman all of his sons. Arjuna, however, was struck with great wonder after visiting the transcendental world by the grace of Lord Krishna. And by the grace of Krishna, he could understand that whatever opulence there may be within this material world is an emanation from him. Any opulent position a person may have within this material world is due to Krishna's mercy. One should therefore always be in Krishna consciousness, in complete gratefulness to Lord Krishna, because whatever one may possess is all his mercy. Arjuna's wonderful experience due to the mercy of Krishna is one of the many thousands of pastimes performed by Lord Krishna during his stay in this material world. They were all unique and have no parallel in the history of the world. All these pastimes prove fully that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yet, while present within this material world, he played just like an ordinary man possessing many worldly duties. He played the part of an ideal householder, and although he possessed 16,000 wives, 16,000 palaces, and 160,000 children, he also performed many sacrifices just to teach the royal order how to live in the material world for the welfare of humanity. As the ideal Supreme Personality, he fulfilled the desires of everyone, from the Brahmins, the highest persons in human society, down to the ordinary living entities, including the lowest of men. Just as King Indra is in charge of distributing rain all over the world to satisfy everyone in due course, so Lord Krishna satisfies everyone by pouring down his causeless mercy. His mission was to give protection to the devotees and to kill the demoniac kings. Therefore, he killed many hundreds and thousands of demons. Some of them he killed personally, and some were killed by Arjuna, who was deputed by Krishna. In this way, he established many pious kings, such as Yudhishthira, at the helm of world affairs. Thus, by his divine arrangement, he created the good government of King Yudhishthira, and there ensued peace and tranquility. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purport of the third volume, 20th chapter of Krishna, the super excellent power of Krishna.